Yeah, I'll return the homework at the end of class.
And as soon as I still have time, I'll say a little bit about my solution to homework 34, because a lot of you asked me about that one.
Yeah.
And of course, you can also read my explanation and see my spreadsheets. It's all on the website now. So we are on day 42. So I'm going to return homework 31 to 36.
Now, maybe I can just pass it around. Do I have it here? Yeah. Here. I'll just pass it around. It's sorted by last name. Pattern, three class days after the last homework in a batch is assigned, the batch is due. So the next batch of homework will be due Wednesday next week. Now, last time we were looking at this tetrahedron, so I just wanted to say a little bit more about the tetrahedron because we had time to finish that problem, find the mass of the tetrahedron. I wanted to write down an algebraic expression, more algebraic looking expression. We did put it all together in one big formula. On which side of each of four planes we are on. And if you boil down all the geometric thinking we did into a formula, we found a more useful description of that same tetrahedral region. We described it as the region where x is between 0 and 1, and y is between 0 and 1 minus x, and z is between 0 and 1 minus x minus y. That's what all of our slicing and figuring out the bounds of our slices amounted to. And then we put all that together to say that the mass of the tetrahedron, this triple integral, was an iterated integral. I didn't write it down as an iterated integral. I just did each of the three integrals from inside to outside. But if you write it out all as one big iterated triple integral, then one advantage of writing it out this way is that if all you need is a number, you may not have to actually do the integral. You may just be able to type this big formula into your calculator.
So, for example,
if I wanted to type that into my calculator,
what would I say? That's how it would look in my calculator, because the first you do the integral sign, open parenthesis, then instead of a differential, like say a dx, I just type in the variable of integration. Right? I don't put the dx expression in anywhere. It takes the differential as implicit. You just tell differential what variable, and then you give it the limits of integration.
So I could check my work that way if I have something where I actually have formulas and all that.
So the part where the human really adds value is thinking through something like this and converting it into this form, right, where I can more properly express as one nice iterated integral. There's some reasoning here. It's not as easy to teach a computer to go from here to here. But once you get to this level, it's much easier for the computer, the calculator, to take over. In general, you have this kind of pattern. And it doesn't have to be x first, then y, then z, right? Well, maybe I'll put the letters differently. How about I put y first? Mix things up a bit. Right? Just to show you what's possible. Change the order a little bit. But you have this kind of description where you have bounds that are just numbers for the first slice, then bounds that are just a function of your previous slicing variable, and then finally bounds that are functions of your two previous slicing variables. Then if you have to integrate some function here, let's call it C, whatever letter you want. Right? Then as an iterated integral, it'll look like this. The outermost integral is the biggest kind of slice, some kind of cross-section. And then you slice the cross-sections into long, skinny columns. And then finally you slice the skinny columns into little boxes. Thank you.
And likewise for other orderings of the slicing variables. In this example, it was. I sliced first y, then x, then z, but.
You can put it in any of the six possible orders, right? In this one, it's x, y, z, but other orders are possible. You just change the letters, but the pattern is the same. Now, you get a very similar phenomenon if you're doing cylindrical coordinates. Okay.
Cylindrical is very easy if you're comfortable with polar coordinates, right? So with polar coordinates, we have the link between the Cartesian x and y, the horizontal and the vertical, and the polar radial and angular coordinates. And cylindrical coordinates adds really nothing new except we leave z alone. Z is just z.
Nothing changes in the z direction. So
if, say, you had a region R and you were able to express it in polar coordinates, maybe like this. This is an example where you slice with z first. And if you can express the region with nice bounds like this, then again, it's just going to be a nice iterated integral expression. So let's say here I have, okay, so first I should make z slices, then with each z slice, I ask what angular positions are possible, and then the slices will look like wedges, where you have roughly a constant angular position. Then within that one, you ask what radial positions are possible, so you'd have something like maybe I'll use letters P and Q now. Right? So if you had this scenario and you need to do this integral, you've got some polar bounds on it like this, then we would iterate it in the order of slices that we chose to get these bounds. So in this case, first the z, then the, in this case, I picked a slice with the angles next. Possible angle coordinates, of course, depends on which z cross-section you're on, in general. And then, in this case, I sliced. The last thing I did was take my little wedge of roughly constant angular position, and I chopped it up into a bunch of little pieces of concentric rings from the wedge. And it's roughly little boxes, but they're actually a little bit kind of curved boxes. So everything looks pretty much the same, just different letters. Until now, right, things get different. because if we have a function x of xyz here, to do this integral, we need to use now the cylindrical coordinates. And then we have to remember how the little curvy boxes we have work in terms of their volume. Remember the formula for the arc length of a circle, right? For a circular arc. Right? It's radius times radian angular. The total change in the angular position from end to end measured in radians times the radius is the actual length, right? And now there's a third dimension, z. Otherwise, it's before. So it's the rdr d theta formula like before, but now times dz. So we have to bring that in to here. Okay, so in the innermost slice, in this example, we have dependence on R, right? R is not a constant in the innermost thing here where we have a wedge. We're looking at the different range of grade, the different R ranges here. We're adding up all of these little pieces to make some skinny wedge. And so we can't factor the R and dr out here. They're not constant. R is varying. But the theta and the z in this example are constant within each of these wedges. So you can factor the d theta and the dz out. And likewise, the within here, within this second level integral here, you're adding up a bunch of wedges to get a z cross section. So within one of those z cross sections, it's all the same dz. Z is roughly constant. You can factor out that dz. So here's the r, dr, d theta, dz. That's the volume part, dv here. But when things are constant, we can factor them out to the from inner integral to outer integral. So very much alike. This is really just the polar coordinate transformation. Now you just have to remember that there's a third variable, z.
But you're not doing anything interesting with z that you hadn't done in the Cartesian case. So the hard part is usually not this. The hard part is getting the bounds in the first place, if they're not just given to you. Okay. So where we'll go next is we'll do an example problem with cylindrical coordinates. Any questions or comments? Okay. So again, there's nothing special about this particular slicing order, right? I chose in this example slice with z, then theta, then r, but you don't have to slice in that order. You can slice in whatever order makes the integral the simplest or makes it the simplest to figure out the bounds. Thank you.
Start with something that's not too hard. Let's think about that cone from homework 35. Okay. And I need to restrict z to be non-negative to avoid getting a double cone. Homework 35, where I did the slicing in two different orders for finding the volume of the cone in terms of the double integral. You don't really need a triple integral to find the volume, because you can always just think of it as just stopping once you get to the point of wedges or columns. And then you just need to know the height or length of each column or wedge. You can see it as a triple integral if you want. This is called the cone. So let's start with something. Say we just want to express the volume now in a triple integral instead of a double integral. Sometimes it's actually slightly simpler conceptually to do it this way. You just think of, okay, I have to add up the volume of all the little pieces. Let's do this with polar coordinates here. Okay. Or cylindrical coordinates. So, one little trick here, okay, is that x squared plus y squared is r squared, because cosine squared plus sine squared is 1. Ultimately, it's about the Pythagorean theorem, right? Okay, so that x squared plus y squared is just an r squared. That's one of the reasons why cylindrical coordinates actually makes this a lot easier. So that looks nice, in that we get nice simple bounds for z. So our cone is actually a nice simple description now. Set of all points x, y, z where r squared, which by the way is always non-negative. It's a cone, right? So I need a square on the z. Square roots here. Let me get something nice. And of course, we know that we're always taking the non-negative square root. We want, if we're doing polar coordinates, it's really helpful to avoid the negative r, if at all possible. There's no need for it here. Now, one other thing you might ask, what about the angular coordinate? Right. There should be some kind of, what can we say about the restriction on theta? Right.
Let's compare it to pi.
Yeah.
Yeah, 0 to 2 pi. There's really no restriction on theta,
except that we don't want to double count volume, okay? I mean, if you think about this, we've really got the axis of the cone here, right? There's the positive z-axis, right? And here's the origin at the bottom of this cone, right? So you can have, say this is your x-axis, this is your y-axis. You imagine what kind of angles are possible? Well, any angle you want. And just don't double count positions. So don't go over an interval of angles longer than 360 degrees. So if you want to be pedantic, I should have put that in here as well. Some people would argue it's implicit in the notation. Oh yeah, if there's no restriction, the polar coordinates can be anything that you want, or the angular coordinate can be anything you want. There, it's nice and explicit. Okay. So there's a little bit more to do here. We have to make sense of this thing. It's not quite in one of these nice forms we have down here, right? And down here we've got this nice setup where it's z just ranges between some constants, and then we have another variable that ranges just between functions of z, and then the last variable ranges between the functions of the earlier slicing variables. But here we don't really have that yet because r is between 0 and z. Z is between r and 2. So that's not quite in the form we want yet, because with the first slice we make, we need to have pure numerical bounds for that first slicing variable. Okay, so I think it's easiest to see that z can be as high as 2 and no higher, right? Yeah. And it can be as low as 0, right? If you have freedom with this r here to be anything between 0 and z, you can push the r down as close to 0 as you want. Hence, you're free to push the z down right after it as close to 0 as you want. So we're going to rewrite this as, if we say slice with z first, we're going to rewrite it as z can be anything between 0 and 2. So we think of it first, we pick a z level, so we make a circular cross-section on our cone, and then within that circular cross-section, we have a constraint on r. In this case, r is stuck between 0 and z. So in this form now, the order of our slicing will be z, then r, then theta. Now we're good to go. So from 0 to 2 for z. And then from 0 to z for r. And then from 0 to 2 pi for theta. And the dv is the rdr d dz now. And down here. So let's reorder it. The innermost integral will be a theta integral. So I'm going to factor out the rdr dz because the first slice makes z roughly constant. The second slice makes r roughly constant.
I'm just going to write the letter names in. Make it easier to follow.
So first we make a slice. It's going to be a circular cross-section of carbon, roughly constant Z. Then here, what you're doing when you make a slice of constant R is you're carving a ring out of the circle, a thin ring.
So, picture here. That, and a little ring carved out here. And then finally, in the last piece, we've carved out some little chunk of the ring. And so within the ring, R is roughly constant and Z is roughly constant, so that's why I can factor out the R dr and the dz. And within the circular cross section, the Z is roughly constant. It's all one thickness dz, so I can factor out that dz.
Now this integral is very easy now that we've actually set it up. And it should be easy because the volume of a cone has a simple formula, right? After all this, we better get the 1/3 base times height, right? The base is a disk of, well, the base is at the top, but regardless, the base is a disk of radius 2, so it's going to be 4 pi in area. And then the height is 2, so we should get 1/3 of 4 times 2 times pi. We should get 8/3 pi, let's see. Okay, so the first integral, easy, right? The antiderivative of 1, if you like, is theta. Plug in 2 pi and 0. The difference is 2 pi. And then this one is easy. Right? You can factor out that 2 pi. And then you've got r, plug in 0 and z. Well, antiderivative is r squared over 2. Plug in z and 0. You take the difference. And let's see. Looks like we'll get pi z squared. Twos cancel, so it's just pi r squared divided by z and 0. Finally, we get pi constant multiple times z cubed over 3, antiderivative at 2 equals z and at 0 equals z. So we plug in 2 and we cube it and we get the 8. We plug in 0 and we get nothing. So we get the 8/3 pi that basic geometry predicts. Okay. Now, of course, this is not worth all the effort if all we're going to do is get the volume of a cone. Right? We can do more interesting stuff, right? For example, what did we do with triple integrals yesterday? We found the mass of something, not just the volume. So let's see about that. So now that we've already got the integral set up, we could do lots of stuff, right? Let's say that the mass is proportional to the radius, okay, for example. And say the constant proportionality is 5, okay, in some units, all right?
So then you want to know, maybe you're interested in this. You're interested in the mass of the cone, given this this kind of density, where it gets more dense as you go out away from the z-axis. So it would just be this integral now. And it's already in cylindrical coordinates, so I don't even need to convert from Cartesian, so it's great. So now let me write out my big triple integral here. Z goes from 0 to 2, r goes from 0 to z, theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. And then now instead of just a dv times a 1, it's a dv times a density, so 5r and d theta dr, oops, r dr, dz. You can factor out the 5r, because this inner integral is all about theta, with r and z held constant. So if you factoring out the 5r and just doing this integral, you get 2 pi again, so you get 10 pi r. Times an r from here. So it's 10 pi r squared that we integrate next. And this will be, so an r squared will have a 1/3 r cubed antiderivative, so 10 pi over 3, plug in z of 0, get z cubed. Okay, here we go again. Now we're going to have z to the 4th over 4 is the next antiderivative, so we get 10 pi over 3 times 4 z to the 4th at 2 and 0. Okay, 16 to the 4th divided by 4 is 4, so we get 40/3 pi. Pick a different shape. Let's see. Say we have something more like a football shape, kind of like this. And so the restriction here, I'm thinking of maybe I let z go from negative 1 to 1. And so there'll be this parabola here. R, on the parabola, we have r equal to, say, one minus z squared over 4. So we get kind of this shape. here you have r equals 0. So the axis, right, the z-axis, will be right in the middle of this. That'll be the axis of rotation of this 3D thing. Okay. And then it's got kind of this curve, you know, shape, like an American football, like that. So we're going to demand that r be between 0 and 1 minus z squared over 4. So radial cross section, like carving a wedge out of this would look like that. Should I call it radial or angular cross section? Let's give it a density. We'll keep it simple. Density is, let's just say it's a constant. It is 3. And so find this integral. This is what we call the moment of inertia. This tells you something about how much energy it takes to spin this thing at a given rate.
Let me see now. Last 5 minutes. Oops. One more. Ah! There we go. So here's my spreadsheet for homework 34. So that is the first thing I did here, create my spreadsheet. For homework 34, we had this region. It was defined by having your x stuck between negative 1 and 1. So my x samples range from negative 0.9 to positive 0.9. What I did there is I think of the interval from negative 1 to 1 as being cut up into 10 equal parts. So the whole interval length was 2. Each tenth of that interval has length 0.2. So the first interval from the left goes from negative 1 to negative 0.8. And the midpoint of that interval would be negative 0.9. The next interval, right, you go from x equals negative 0.8 to negative 0.6. So the midpoint is negative 0.7 and so on. And what do I have in the formulas? I just implemented, you know, since instead of typing it manual, I just have a formula that says, for example, here, take the cell to the left of you and add 0.2. So I did that. So all I had to do was starting value manually, and then I did one more cell where I said add the increment, the 0.2, and then I copied that and pasted it to these cells. And as you can see, it gives them automatically. Like if I delete all these, so copy and then paste. And then I did a similar thing for the y range. The constraint on this thing was y also varied between negative 1 at the low end, and then the highest it could get is also positive 1, but there's an additional restriction that y had to be under x squared. So what I did here is this is my first pass at the problem, is just making a little test function. So in these cells, like look at this cell, what does it say? It says, if cell A6, so if the y coordinate is less than the square of cell G2, the x coordinate, then return 1. Otherwise, return 0. That's what that if this, comma, that, comma, other means, right? If this is true, return the thing, return the second argument. If it's not true, return the third argument. So if y is less than x squared, print out 1. If it's not, print out 0. And the little dollar signs there just tell me, like the dollar sign on the 2 means the x-coordinate will always be on row 2. And the dollar sign in front of the A means the y-coordinate will always be in column A. Whereas there's no dollar sign in front of the 6, there's no dollar sign in front of the G. So the meaning of that 6 is just, since I'm just the current row, because this cell is cell G6. So the 6 means current row, the G means current column. So if I delete a bunch of stuff, say, and I just copy from that G6, then it gets it all back. Because I typed in the general pattern. And then the last thing I did here is I wondered, okay, how many cells am I actually going to keep with my thing here? So I just did a sum, and I tell it sum from, I just selected the rectangle with the mouse actually, and it automatically put in the C4 to L13. And so I just count up all the ones there, and I got 64. I didn't really need to do that, but I was curious, how many cells am I actually going to keep? So 10 by 10 is 100. So 100 potential sample points, but I reject 36 of them and only keep 64. And then I have to actually plug in stuff. So I made a second version here. So I still have the if thing. So if I have a rejected point, I return 0 times whatever, so 0. Otherwise, I return 1 times the important thing. And the important thing was dx times dy times the function value 1 over e to the x plus y squared plus 1. And that's how, because the dx times the dy is the little area of the little square, and then I need the sample value of the function. And so in this example, I cut x and y into intervals of length 0.2. So I have a 0.2 times a 0.2 up there. And then I divide by that exponential of x. And I have a little typo there. I've got the parentheses in the wrong place. I better fix that. That's going to change the whole ball of wax. Okay, I had a little formula error there. I had everything in the denominator inside the exponential. So I was getting this really bad estimate of 0.89, but I'm actually much closer now. 1.12. The true value is about 1.17. So, I'll have to fix that. Okay. All right. So that is how I did it. But looks like we're about at quitting time. Any other questions or comments? Okay, you can see all the homework solutions online, and I'll have to make a little correction to the spreadsheet.